Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of The Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
Buyers and sellers at war. Trade dealers up in the air. We've had a mixed week of economic reports, and we're getting ready for the new year with some listener questions. All this and much more on episode number 639 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Hey there, and a very good day to you. I missed you. This is Andrew Horowitz. I'm the host of the Disciplined Investor Podcast, as well as the host of DH Unplugged, where my co-host is actually John C. Dvorak. We missed last week of DH Unplugged due to a technical issue, a little glitch with AT&T, where we tried everything to get a connection on Skype, and it just didn't work. I mean, it was bad. We had, I took out multiple computers and trying to hook up through my phone, through 5G, trying to get it into the mix. Anyway, long story short, nothing worked. So DH Unplugged was canceled last week. The show notes are still up on dhunplugged.com, but we didn't do that. I also missed you. Last week, we had Thanksgiving. And, you know, I thought that the last podcast we had with Meb Faber was, I guess it was worthy of a two-week airing. And it gave me a little break. I think we've missed maybe one, maybe two shows this year. So I apologize for that. Hope you forgive me. But it was Thanksgiving. And again, I thought it was a good reason to maybe take off the week, refresh, recalibrate, and get back to business today. So hopefully your Thanksgiving was really a good one. I had some family over. And I got to tell you, I did some really good cooking. And cool cooking, I should. Not good. Cool cooking. It was good. It was definitely good. But we did an experiment. I don't know if you have this store around you, but there's a store called The Wild Fork. And what they have is just endless amounts of meats, vegetables, seafood, all frozen, all fast frozen, where it is fresh right when they cut the meat. They, you know, high speed freeze it. They put it into a wrapper in such a way that when you open the meat and defrost it, it looks like it's absolutely fresh, as opposed to a lot of times where you get frozen meats that kind of look like they're frozen. Well, what I thought I would do is, you know, I said, let's check out some good cuts. So I got some Wagyu, I got a tenderloin of beef, and the prices were really reasonable. So I said, all right, we'll try this. And I did the sous vide, and then I torched it. And I got to tell you something, it was unbelievable. At first, I was really skeptical about, you know, I'm going to buy frozen meats. I don't know about that. But I bought them, made them out of control. Just absolutely delicious. The Wagyu was, if you haven't had a good Australian or Japanese Wagyu with, you know, fully marbled and tender and, oh, delicious piece of meat. Not cheap, but delicious. So I had that. I did that. I also made a homemade smoked slaw. I got this little smoking gun, this kind of portable smoking gun where you put either in, you know, whatever it is, hickory or applewood or pecan chips, and it kind of, you know, light it up, and it has a fan with it and blows out the smoke. Well, I made a mayonnaise inside of a food processor and then took the smoker and put it into the food processor and infused the smoke in there. And then I made a slaw and I topped that over Argentinian sausages and put those on some really yummy bread for some Sammies. Oh, that was amazing. And then, just to finish off this little food segment here, I'll mention that it's stone crab season down here. And I had my first stone crabs of the year, and they were marvelous. Got a little guy, a little truck that sells them on the side of the road, and it's $36 a pound for the colossals, $20 a pound for the mediums, which is reasonably priced. That's definitely a good price for these. And They were just incredible. If you haven't had a chance to get stone crabs during the season, I really encourage you to do so. They're great. They're cold. For those of you that don't know, these are cold. They're hard-shelled. And you dip them in like a different sauce. You could do cocktail sauce if you want. But the traditional way to do it, Florida style, is in a kind of a mayonnaise-y mustard sauce. And you can make it or you can buy it. It's pretty easy to make. It's got mayonnaise and Coleman's mustard in it, Worcestershire sauce, and A1 steak sauce. And you mix that around. Pretty amazing. So a lot of great times on Thanksgiving. Hopefully, like I said, you had a great time as well. A lot has transpired over the last couple of weeks since we last were together. And while we've talked about this whole trade deal over the last 2 years now, is it going on 2 years? It's got to be close to 2 years. But we talked about this a lot, and I thought I'd just take a moment here today to talk about it again, just very briefly, and put a few comments on this. We're going to talk about some listener questions. And by the way, if you do want to ask any questions that we can answer on a show upcoming, you can go over to thedisciplinedinvestor.com, click on Ask Andrew, and just type away, ask your question, and we'll get it on the show. Lots of information over on The Disciplined Investor, as well as show notes for the episodes, information about the guests that we have on, and all the information about the strategies that we manage for clients. Because yes, that's what we do. We manage money for clients. So if you haven't figured that out by now, that's what we do. It's not just only a podcast, but the podcast is a means to really get some great guests to not only enlighten you, but also enlighten me. It gives me a great insight into the world of investing by some of the best people out there. And that's why, in fact, we do it each and every week. It's a combination plan where I can gather information and expand my knowledge base and at the same time help you to expand your knowledge base. Works really well. So again, back to this area of the trade deal. So one of the things I noticed this week, and it became very clear, very apparent, and very just, I guess almost, I'm convinced that both sides are toying with markets. Both sides are now in the mode that they don't want anything to upset the markets any further for China, and they want to keep the whole rally going here in the United States. And both sides are now coming with comments on a regular basis that are all about mini trial balloons, but then back, you know, walking them back very soon after. So, for example, we get something that talks about that, oh, you know what, President Trump says, maybe we won't do a trade deal till after the election. And markets, what? What are you talking about? Markets fell about 350 points on that news, down as low as close to 500 points on the day that he mentioned that. And then just the next day, they're walking it back saying, you know what, there's a lot of progress has been made, and we think we're going to get something done. Even though President Trump said that if it's not down on paper by December 15th, the December 15th tariffs will go into place, the increase on tariffs. But then they walked it back. Treasury Secretary Mnuchin, Wilbur Ross, and then you had, of course, Larry Kudlow's Friday appearance to try to talk it all up and to walk back anything to clean up the mess that was made during the week. I think that's his position. He cleans up the mess on a Friday after all the things that were put out there during the week that may have upset markets in one way or another. Make it look like, hey, you know what? Things are really progressing really in a positive manner. And I think that doing this to and saying these things to keep us believing that a deal is close. I've talked about this before, about the whole carrot and the stick, and that's what's going on here. And even though sometimes they put out commentary that are questionable, I think they're really doing it just to really test the markets. I really do believe that. And again, figuring out what it is that's going to impact the markets the most, what's going to be good, what's going to be bad, and then clean it up by the end of the week. And it's also clear from all of this, if you really step back for a second, let's just kind of, in unison, take a breath and think about this for a second. The question about if we put all this information together, everything we've heard over the last, let's even just say 6 months, everything we've heard, talked about from both sides about China, yeah, they'll agree to a skinny partial, you know, deal that's going to push up agricultural purchases and maybe drop some tariffs. And then the U.S. saying, well, you know what? Hey, well, we want to get some intellectual property stuff in there, but, you know, things are going well. And if we kind of look back and compile all the information that was put out, whether it's by the newspapers, media, whether it's by the source themselves, whether it's by commentary by the lieutenants involved in this, I think it's very clear that we're no closer to any kind of deal today than we were 4 months ago, 5 months ago. This skinny, partial phase one trade deal was supposed to be an easy task where we were going to go very quickly into the deals that were so easy to put together. And then we'll get to the hard stuff. However, that doesn't play out. It's not even easy to get a very simple buying of agricultural products, reduction of tariffs, and a few other little things in there to get that out of the way in order to start the conversation going about some of the harder issues regarding intellectual property issues, technology transfer, theft, you know, all these various things that are really at the heart of this trade deal. Now you say, Andrew, but is that really impacting anything? Who cares? The markets don't care. Well, yeah, the markets don't care here in the U.S., and we're going to talk about that in a second. Some of the drivers that are helping the markets stay and propel to all-time highs or near about those levels. But, you know, they are impacting other areas around the world. I mean, we just talked about putting tariffs on steel on Brazil and Argentina. We're going to be threatening tariffs of 100% on various champagnes, caviars, high-end consumer goods from France because of what they did with their recent technology commentary and fines on some of our technology companies. Not to mention, it has shown up incrementally in a global slowdown. Now, if it was simply just the trade war that was out there and the isolationism that we're trying to get to here in the United States, doing away with the globalization that was pretty much a 30-year process in order to get to the level of we are today, I think the entire world would be in a recession. But lo and behold, we have central banks. And again, we're going to get to that in a second, but we have central banks that are helping through very easy monetary policies, low interest rates, quantitative easing, you know, name all the things they're doing. And you'll realize that that backstop has prevented the entire world from going into a recession. I mean, really, that's what's going on right now. And I think this grand plan of keeping the carrot out there and continually throwing up trial balloons and talking about the trade deal and putting all these dates in there, you know, if you don't do it by this date, then we're going to threaten to do that. And then talking about how things are going well, then saying, you know what, it's not going so well. I really think this is a grand plan to keep the Fed and central banks involved as they're looking at the rest of the world's economy slipping and they're worried about that there's no longer anything really out there that could really propel markets because of the trade war. And if the trade war continues longer than it is now, and if we have this elongated process of tariffs, it's hurting countries, it's hurting companies. But again, the Fed is in play. The global central banks are in play. And I think the big concern they have is the central banks are reading this as problematic, and that's why they're stepping in so quickly with such a massive amount of stimulus. The longer this goes on, the more likely that will impact the United States eventually. Therefore, our Fed in particular needs to be very dovish. I mean, doesn't that make sense? This is a giant game that's being played. It's a game of economic warfare within our own country where we're trying to keep the Fed in play, or the administration's trying to keep the Fed in play. and the reality that every other country around the world will start stimulating because they have yet to see any kind of negative implication from all the debt they have on their books from a country level or from a central bank level. China is just going to stimulate. And if you watch a lot of the news, particularly like a Bloomberg News or CNBC, every time you see that there is a negative report on either economics, whether it's China's, for example, let's say we say China's GDP is slowing down, or their industrial production has slowed down, or industrial profit is slowing down. The tagline right after that is, and that gives ammunition to the central bank for more stimulus. And then the central banks come out and say, you know what, we have more room. Of course they do. They have an unlimited amount of room. So the central banks are playing against this whole trade deal. The people involved in the trade deal realize that, you know what, if they push hard enough, the central banks are going to step up because they just have to. And then when they finally get some kind of resolution, whether it's a good resolution or if it's just a simple, you know, skinny partial phase one trade deal, then who knows what's going to happen with markets. You get so much stimulus in the system and you have so much, the rates that are so low right now, that is bound to pop markets if we get rid of some of the things that are overhanging. Now, you remember the repo operations and that incident we saw a couple of months ago, it was somewhere in September or so, where overnight, all of a sudden, there was this liquidity crisis. And we saw rates pop up, what was it, close to 10% on an overnight lending, where they're usually, 1% or 2%, even less than that. And it was a giant surprise. Everybody's like, oh my God, what happened? And then there was a lot of discussion about, it's not anything to worry about. It was just a shortfall that wasn't really accounted for of corporate taxes at the end of the quarter, end of the month. And all this kind of discussion came out trying to pat down the concern. And the Fed said, well, it's really only a temporary issue. But what we're going to do is we're going to put some money into the system. And they immediately put in, $50, $75 billion into the system. That's all it was. $75 billion would take care of the situation. But then they did something a little tricky. Really tricky, actually. What did they do? They decided that it's going to be an open-ended process. An open-ended process, meaning they're going to keep on putting money into it. But they made sure to quickly announce that this is not to be considered quantitative easing. This is not money. We're not going to increase the balance sheet for the purpose of quantitative easing. All we're trying to do is keep liquidity in the system. Because the overnight lending system is very important for banks and for the overnight lending within the economy and for companies to maintain a very fluid transaction process. So therefore, we need to keep this working pretty well. So where are we? That ended up not being a single, solitary, one-off, quick impact by the Fed to try to solve a problem that was this overnight aberration that just had to be solved and it'd be money in and money out. No. If you calculate how much they have actually put in since September, it's upwards of $300 billion. With operations, again, this last week. So this overnight lending snafu that was all of a sudden this big concern that was solved. Yeah, it's a small issue, even though it's $85 billion. Small issue that would be solved by a quick infusion of capital turned out to be this crazy, I'll call it QE4. Yeah, listen, they're trying their best to convince us this is not QE. However, if you really look, and I did some calculations on this, since the start of September, $304 billion of growth of the Fed's balance sheet, which is an average of $100 billion per month. $100 billion a month when this was supposed to be a one-off situation. Now, tie this back to what I talked to before about, the Fed has their back up against a wall due to this whole trade war. Not only the Fed, but the rest of the central banks around the world. And then let's put it into perspective. The last QE, we called a QE3. It started September 2012. At that time, everybody was pretty excited about, wow, they're really going to be pushing money into the markets, liquefying it. And we know that when that happens, it somehow finds its way into risk assets over time. But back then, when we had an official QE, it was only $40 billion per month. And then, if you remember what happened after that, a few months later, they thought, you know what, that wasn't enough. They really need to work on this to bring down rates and to push around the market rate. And they went up to $85 billion per month. And all told, between QE1, QE2, QE3, the Fed blew up their balance sheet by a total of $4.5 trillion of bonds since when they started back in 2009. 2010, right around there. You know, when everything was just bad, when they need to put $800 billion in one shot to save the banks. And then it grew from there. And then when we follow that from the QE2 and QE3, and we move forward into 2013, markets were doing better, and the Fed announced they're tapering, right? They were going to start slowing down on the QE program. They start allowing things to roll off slowly but surely. And what we saw was the balance sheet assets were starting to come down. And they were starting to come down slowly. They were trimmed down to $3.7 trillion in August of 2019. Then boom! Now we're over $4 trillion again. Over $4 trillion again in an economy that seems to be relatively stable, with a stock market that is all-time highs. Credit spreads are pretty good shape. And now we have rates that have been reduced 3 times in the last several months. So if you're wondering why, in a time when we've seen just a pretty significant and regular amount on a monthly basis of net outflows of equity mutual funds and ETFs, how on earth is the stock market at all-time highs? And I think if you really focus on what's going on here, valuations are being expanded, multiples being expanded due to the fact that rates are lower, no question about that. And quantitative easing. Yes, folks, I have an announcement. The $100 billion per month on average that's been put into and increased the Fed's balance sheet over the last 3 months is, in fact, wait for it, it is QE4. Come on. If you believe the Fed in their discussion of saying it's not quantitative easing, what else is it? I mean, if it walks like a duck, it talks like a duck, and smells like a duck, man, it's a freaking duck. So, I mean, I don't know what to say about this. But the realization is that we need to understand this, because this is some of the reason that markets are actually continuing to move to highs when, in fact, there is very little retail participation. I mean, because, you know, a couple hundred billion dollars, and what's a couple hundred billion dollars between friends anyway? And that's only here in the U.S. If you think about what's going on in Japan and Europe, they're still buying massive amounts of bonds through their own quantitative easing programs. Not to mention that Japan is actually buying ETFs and, well, let's just call it stocks, on their exchange. I mean, they own like 70% of the overall bonds in their country, and they have, I don't know, 50 or 60% of equities on the Nikkei are owned by the Bank of Japan. Sovereign wealth funds around the world with essentially unlimited amounts of money are also buying individual stocks. And let's not forget about the repurchases by companies, share buybacks. Those are also putting money in. So when you kind of put this all together, you have all these massive players out there that are really pushing up individual stock prices, expanding valuations, not really caring about where the true valuation is because there's so much money that's floating around the system, and that's what's happening. And a lot of this is because of the trade war right now. While it is, in fact, weakening the economy, the U.S. is the benefactor of the stock market moving up because of it, because of the excess liquidity that's been put into the system. I said this before, and I'm going to say it again. The fact is, it's not going to end well. This will not end well with all this debt amassed on the balance sheets of the central banks and, you know, around the world. It's just not. Now, I've also said it's a bomb at the end of a fuse, but the fuse is very long because they continue to pump money into this. And what's inevitably going to happen is that economies won't get out of the funk. Inflation will probably stay subdued for some time. Growth will be, you know, below average because the debt requirements to pay off are substantial. And that is going to balloon the deficits and cause a lot of problems. And what this is telegraphing to investors is twofold. And that's why we're seeing the markets react like it is. Lower rates can help support higher valuations. That's the first thing that they believe, because it's true. When you look at the calculation of a discounting model, whatever kind of model you're looking at, when you use a risk-free rate of return and put it into the process, and that risk-free rate of return is lower, a valuation of a particular risk asset could be, in fact, higher because it makes more sense over time to get that, especially as an alternative to some of the risk-free assets. The second thing is that is telegraphing right now to investors is that I think central banks don't care about the debt. They don't care about the amount that they're carrying, and they don't care about adding to that. And pretty much that's a green light for investors believing that central banks will continue to be a backstop, a safety net in times that are troubling. And that's why markets are reacting the way they are right now. Bad news is transitory and good news is reality. And I think that deserves some breakdown, right? I mean, when you say that, you know, I could just say very simply, you know, bad news is good news and good news is good news. But bad economic news or issues with the trade deal, news of potential impeachment, Brexit, all these are, I think these are looked at by investors as solvable problems with resolutions that will come out that are going to be reasonable. Maybe not now, but sometime in the future. So you look at this and you say, well, we have all these negative things that are going on right now, but somehow magically over time, maybe just by throwing money at the situation, all these things have been solved over time. Even when we look back at the worst case scenario back at the nadir, worst, just horrible, just deathly look of the markets and banks back in 2008, 2009. I mean, really, what happened? Most banks were bailed out. A couple went under. Businesses went under. Yes, I agree with you there. But generally speaking, enough money was thrown at the situation that has solved the problem. So when we look at what's going on now, I think central banks pouring money into markets and buybacks still significant. There's the view that as soon as we get past this, as soon as we get beyond, whether it's Brexit, whether it's the tariffs and the trade deal, the trade war, that the amount of money that's being poured into the problem will pretty much at least keep us elevated for some time until it's solved. And once it's solved, it's smooth sailing from there. I mean, think about where we are now. We're approaching the December 15th deadline for the tariff increase on key consumer products. This is going to be a problem for companies like an Apple. We got consumer electronics, technology. All this is going to be, inclusion in tariffs, and several other areas are going to see an increase in tariffs. And everybody knows that the Trump administration is watching the markets like a hawk. I mean, they're on this all the time because they talk about it all the time. The administration, they don't really want anything to cause a major sell-off because that would be detrimental to the economy, right? And if it's detrimental to the economy, well, let's face it, the election's not too far away. So good news kind of reinforces the idea that companies in the U.S. economy are essentially impervious to a global slowdown. They're, you know, outside the impact of a global slowdown. Is that true? I still see we are having a slowdown in a lot of areas. We're not necessarily, we don't have a moat around us. Let's put it that way, that a lot of people think we do. But this good news reinforces the idea that companies are doing okay. Therefore, buying dips makes sense in a broad scheme, and buying breakouts is also good. So that's what's kind of driving markets right now. The idea that we'll get past this. And if it takes a long time, well, we got the Fed at our back. Central banks around the world pouring in money. Trump administration really is not going to let a lot happen to the markets as best as they can help it, because they use that as a tool for their political gain. And when I say political gain, meaning that the better markets do, the better the economy does into the election cycle, the better the chances are that he'll be reelected. So then you have to ask the question, though, what can actually stop this cycle? What could break this cycle, this psychology that has permeated inside the markets? I mean, what could really break this down? And I don't really know the answer to that, I'll be honest with you. However, you could see that if, in fact, there is no taking back of the threat to increase the tariffs on December 15th, and if they go through, because don't forget, there are comments from the president said, if we do not have a deal in writing, on paper, then these tariffs are going to go through. But the bets are that even if there isn't anything in writing, that if we don't have anything done, the potential for a postponement of these is pretty high. Because if you think about it, we've seen this happen before. We've seen this sign of good faith. And right now, the markets are betting that they're not going to let this disagreement lead to this really problematic increase that's going to happen potentially on December 15th. So I think if, in fact, we do put those on, I think markets are going to recalibrate a little bit. But then again, with that in mind, it's hard to believe that the Trump administration, with where they are in the election cycle and at the end of the year during holiday season, won't walk this back and just take a little bit of pie and say, well, you know what, we'll do it in... You know what, right now we're going to just let it go, because it's the end of the year, of course. We're going to let it go to January 15th. I'm going to give it one more month because we're so close. So close. Because also we're in a seasonally, generally a good period for markets. We'll call it the turkey trot. We've seen this before. We've seen that post-Thanksgiving into Christmas, you get the Santa Claus rally, things, you know, not all the time, but seasonally. On average, this is a good time for markets. So again, last year was not. I mean, really not. But we do have all this going on with these outside forces and the Fed and the governments, and they really want to make sure that last year's debacle at the end of the year doesn't happen, and this year ends on a high note to kind of prove their worth. To prove that, you know what, that happened, we made a mistake, we rectified it. We're not increasing interest rates anymore. We're actually reducing them. We're not doing QE, but we are doing QE. So it would seem that the one thing that really could break this cycle right now is December 15th. And we're talking about less than a week away, or about a week away. December 15th. Keep that in mind. Keep that on your calendar. Pay attention to what happens there. Again, the bet is in the probability and odds are that the increase won't happen due to the fact that where we are from a political standpoint. I think it would be a mistake not to. If you're really playing the game right, if you're really trying to win this trade war, if you're really trying to make a statement and really hurt China, if they don't do what you want them to do, be a gigantic mistake not to put these on. Now, I don't want them on, personally. I want this whole thing to go away. Get back to business. But I think from a gamesmanship positioning status and structure, that you don't want this, a time when you have an upper hand right now to a degree, and they may be sweating on some of this, to kind of be wasted and then make you look weak, because we look weak already. We already postponed the October 15th tariffs. It looks like we're caving on a few other things. So I don't know, kind of a little bit torn between the realities here of what could happen. Let's see what happens. 1 week to go. All right, let's take a look at what's coming up next week, some things that happened this week, and some of the things that can be market moving. Before we get to next week, let's talk about, wow, that employment report. The employment picture in the U.S. is pretty healthy. I mean, that print from Friday was nothing but super impressive. We had, 266,000 new additions to the payrolls. We had a rate of unemployment of 3.5%. Plus, if that wasn't enough, the last couple of months were revised higher. Total about 40,000 new additions added to the payrolls over the last couple of months. Now, this is interesting because we saw that the ADP private payrolls came down a little bit, but I mean, I think they came in at 66,000. Expectations were like 124. So I don't know where this differential is, but from a pure economic viewpoint, taking the numbers for what they are, it clearly shows that the employment picture in the United States is looking pretty good. ISM manufacturing that came out recently, still showing a contraction and slowing down. So manufacturing in the U.S., it's not doing so well. ISM services slowed a bit, but still we saw confidence was up, and confidence still showing a pretty elevated level in terms of overall strength in that area. Now, let's just back up one point. There was 40,000 more people added to the payrolls this period because of the GM strike. The workers went back to work, so we kind of wash that out from the previous month into this month, but that was all still included in the expectations for about 167,000 gain, and this 266 was just a blockbuster. Next week, we have some interesting things happening. We have the CPI, or the inflation numbers that are coming out. Expectations are for about 0.2% month-over-month rate of increase, whereas last month, we saw a pretty hot number up 0.4%. If we see more of those surprises to the upside, I think people are going to take notice that, hey, you know what? This inflation thing is starting to get out of control, and maybe why the Fed recently announced that, you know what? They're going to let inflation fluctuate over the 2% threshold for a while. They're not really that concerned about it. We have an FOMC rate decision on Wednesday, and who knows what they're going to do with that one. But they've been pretty clear over the last couple of months that, you know what? What they've done is what they call it, mid-cycle adjustment. Mid-cycle adjustment, yeah. The mid-cycle adjustment that they did is pretty much done. Unless there's some very pointed information that comes out that tells them otherwise in terms of the data points, they're pretty much done. They're going to stand pat for a while. And the data, at this point, from what I can see, supports no further cuts. Frankly, I don't think the data that we saw previously supported any cuts either, but that's another story. On Friday, we're going to see retail sales along with import prices and export prices. It's going to round out the week, and then kind of getting into the home stretch. The home stretch, that's it. The home stretch. So we'll see what happens from there. Let's get to some listener questions that we've amassed over the last couple of weeks. You can always get to us and send in your question by going over to thedisciplinedinvestor.com and going on to the Ask Andrew button and just ask away. We'll answer some of those that are appropriate for the show that we think that are pretty interesting that other people will enjoy. And if it's a question that maybe is a little bit more personalized, I'll send you an email and give you some thoughts on that as well. Over at askandrew@thedisciplinedinvestor.com. That's not the email. Don't send it to that. Just go to you have to go to the website. The website has a little form so you can put in a whole bunch of stuff in there. All right, let's get to this. So our first question comes in from Stacy Ringelsplaw. I probably butchered that. Stacy R. And Stacy asks, he says, hey, Andrew, can you talk more about how VIX options are priced? My research tells me they actually price off the futures and not the current VIX number. I'm also interested in selecting the best expiration. Front month options are moving closely with the VIX, but there's in hedging for the next 3 to 6 months. Well, if you're going to buy VIX options on the VIX, they are priced at the VIX level. So I'm not sure if you're looking at a particular... I'm not sure what you're looking at here, Stacy, to be honest with you. I'm not. I think that really when we look at this and you look at a VIX option and the option starts with VIX, it should be priced to the VIX. Now, obviously, the VIX is a product of other... the product itself is, you know, it can be priced in a lot of different ways, but I think that the VIX itself, when you look at the options, are priced at the option level. I mean, I think that's the bottom line on that. So when you look at the overall VIX option, pick one, I think, as I would say, a little bit out of the money. If you're looking, I'm assuming you're looking at calls. That's what I'm assuming, because that's probably what you're looking to do, especially if you're looking to do some hedging. And if you look at 3 to 6 months out, you know, there's really no particular way. This problem is I prefer to hedge maybe 2 months out on the VIX, maybe three on the outside. Going 6 months out, very difficult because the pricing of it usually is a bit chunky, let's say that. Because, of course, there's a lot of unknowns. What the VIX is really representing is the unknown risk associated and volatility associated with the markets. The longer you go out, the more potential you have for some of that, you know, smoothing. And at the same time, the shorter you go, the more uncertainty there is for any quick move on the VIX. So I would rather you kind of layer in maybe a bunch of monthly VIXs, maybe a 2 month, then kind of renew it and look to move into another 2 months out from where you are today, then moving all the way out 6 months on the scale. I hope that answers. A little bit of confusion there. I do apologize because I'm not exactly sure what is being thought of here, but the VIX should be, option should be right on the VIX that you're looking at. Let's see. This is from Christian Artuso. Hey, Andrew, as you know, it's important to get information from different sources as to not cloud judgment. I'll go with that. While I do love listening to your podcast, and agree with many of your ideas, is there a podcast information source that you believe brings up good points of topics for conversation, even though they may contradict with some of the disciplined investors? Either way, thank you for your time. You know, Christian, a lot of times we bring on people on the show that have their podcast, you know, so we've had this battle with Frank Herzio. Recently, we had a little bit of a disagreement, you know, in theory with Meb Faber, a couple of really good podcasts right there. You know, I think that when we look at the world of podcasting, you know, you're going to get a lot of opinion out there. And what you should do is, you know, look for those that, I mean, the best way to do it is back to the ratings, right? Look at the ratings that are out there. Look at the people listening to it. Look at the commentary on Twitter. Follow those that are doing conversations that are consistent with maybe alternative opinions that you're looking at. So what you want to do is, you know, look for maybe, just an example. I don't know if this actually exists, but the Bear podcast, the Permanent Bear podcast or the Permanent Bull podcast. Find out what they're doing, kind of listen to that. But, you know, the problem that also comes into play is how much research is really being done to understand what are the topics at hand. And then the presentation back to you as the listener, you know, how is that clean data? So, you know, I would look at back at many of the podcasts that we've done in the past with many of the people that we liked, because again, I don't bring on people that always agree with us. So thanks for that. Daniel Cornwell writes, he says, how much of the wage growth in the U.S. can be attributed to increased minimum wage laws? I suspect this can't be answered quantitatively, but we might get an idea from where the wage increases are coming from, i.e. low income taxes versus middle income, i.e. low income versus middle income. I thought you may have some insight. I think it's very insightful of you, Daniel, of course, to believe that or to see that the minimum wage increases are obviously helping to increase the overall salaries. One of the things that has been perplexing is that we see that companies are doing better. They're earning more money. We see that interest rates are going down, more people employed. All the things that should go into not only the inflation calculation, but also the wage increase, which would therefore push out inflation even higher. But what we're seeing is a bit of a contradiction there where we don't see necessarily that wage increases are happening in a really grand manner. Yeah, we're seeing some growth of wages over time, but really nothing like, wow, that's amazing, right? We're not seeing that. We're seeing, you know, 3.5%, 3.2%, 3.1%, moving up to 3.3%. You know, we're not seeing like all of a sudden a 4% wage increase over time. So I think there is a good amount of attribution that can be laid on the fact that we have these increases in minimum wages. And of course, the employment situation helps to provide, because we're almost at full employment, a push in wages as well. So I think the combination of those things are helping both of those, which again should theoretically turn around and push up inflation, which isn't happening. A little weird. Our economy is strange. The things that are supposed to be happening aren't happening. Things that are supposed to be breaking things aren't breaking things. Things that aren't supposed to break things break things. It's kind of a weird economic environment that we're in right now. So thanks for the question, Daniel. Appreciate that. Let's see. So this question comes from Adia Gandhi. And Adia writes, I look forward to and listen to your podcast every week. Thank you. Huge fan. Thank you. Appreciate that. I'm participating in an investment series competition and want to gather your views on a certain issue I'm facing. How do you value stocks that have tremendous upside if certain things happen? More specifically, how do you value a catalyst that is at best a probabilistic? What do you say here? A probabilistic. A guess, let's just say that. And how do you account for the downside of the catalyst were to bust? Well, you know, you're describing something, for example, like in the biotech sector. Oftentimes you have this asymmetrical potential, whereas if this happens and they maybe get the approval or fast track or maybe even team up with another company, the stock's going to blow up and do really well. If in fact, during the phase, you know, maybe pick whatever particular phase of the trials they're in, something goes wrong, like we saw last week with the company. I'll think of the name. There was a company that some of the work they did on this particular drug to help a specific disease of the kidney didn't work out very well. And the stock was down like 58%. So that's where you have that asymmetrical risk where if things do really well, it could really do wonders. So the problem you have here is that it's very difficult to identify some of those asymmetric risk items in a way that, aside from understanding where those lie and where the risk lie, what's the outcome going to be? Because there are places outside of the actual process that can change things. For example, of course, we know in the trials that things can go, you know, very well or very bad. It all depends. But what about if the FDA steps in and does something? So look at what happened with Juul recently. A company that was seemingly, you know, this vape deal was taking over the world, and the FDA stepped in, and now all of a sudden the company has a significant write-down in their valuation due to the fact that they are not selling their products anymore, essentially. So it's a very difficult thing. And then what you could do theoretically in this kind of scenario is build in some hedging, utilizing some put options. So therefore, you kind of lock in and knock down the potential for loss in these areas. It could be a very expensive proposition, though, to do so. And then just take the upside with a little bit of a cut due to the fact of what you paid on the option. So good question. Good theory. I like it. Let's see what else we have here. Got a lot of questions here. All right. How about this one? We'll end with this one. Core Peterson writes in. He says, in your episode with Frank Curzio, you discussed Disney streaming. Is it possible that the streaming revenue is not as valuable as the data they collect from it? Knowing which shows are trending in which regions, which households have children and what age ranges, being able to add content infomercials to their system about parks, cruises, and other Disney offerings, being able to directly market to households they subscribe, better knowing what merchandise and market in what regions. Yeah, listen, you're hitting the nail on the head. There's no question about what this is all about. It's not only about providing the content, which is very important. Everybody wants our data. All we have to do is harken back to Facebook and how they make their money, why they make their money, why advertisers are interested in it. It's all about who has everything about you. It's basically being able to program their systems to mimic what you like and thereby putting what you want to buy under your nose without you even knowing you wanted to buy it. So I agree with you. Now, Frank is pretty negative on Disney. If you remember that, a couple of shows back, he was dead on looking at this as a short for a variety of different reasons due to the fact that the costs of the streaming are going to be problematic. So far, it hasn't really cracked too significantly post the news that they put up about, you know, the Disney Plus. But I would think that you have something right here that they will be utilizing this, and that is part of what they're trying to do, because utilizing just traditional TV signals is not as powerful as what they can glean from their own system that they can program on their own and watch pretty much everything that you're doing, which, if you know me, I'm totally against and frustrated about everybody watching everything I'm doing and sick and tired of everybody trying to sell me something. It's enough. But that's me. Most people don't seem to care about sharing their information. And these companies are only happy to collect it and use it for their benefit. So, good questions. Again, over on the Disciplined Investor on the Ask Andrew button, you could write in. Thank you so much for your questions and your insights. There's a lot of other fan mail that comes in. You know what? It's that time of year. If you want to send in something, whether it can be good or bad, it can be a criticism, it could be something nice. If you want to put a review up on iTunes, now's the time to do it. So please do so. I very much appreciate it. I read every single email that you send. So we'd love to hear about your thoughts on this year, how the show went, what you like about it, maybe what you don't like about it. All in the name of making sure that we have great content that can provide for you moving forward. Been doing this since 2007, so the formula is somehow doing something right here, and I appreciate that. Don't forget Tuesday nights over on the Disciplined Invest, over on DH Unplugged, excuse me. You can also sign up to get all these over on Twitter by just following me, Andrew Horowitz, one word, because everything that we do and pump out goes on Twitter automatically to make sure that you're aware of everything and you have that information at your fingertips. Of course, if you're interested thinking that maybe it's time to hedge out some of the risk in the portfolio into a long-short strategy, if you want style diversification, if you want trading diversification, some of the things that we do here with our portfolios, and I think that's something you should really investigate, especially as we're getting into the higher valuation end of the spectrum. And seasonality only goes so far in a third-year presidential cycle and the turkey trot into the Santa Claus rally. We'll have to see what that does for next year. But you know what? Never a time like the present, especially when we see such a run-up as we've seen this year, to consider What is your best diversification? You know, are you really situated right? Too many portfolios have a lot of mutual funds, a lot of stocks, and it's just a giant overlap of the same thing over and over. And while that does benefit you potentially when times are good, you know how much it hurts you when things don't go your way. So check out all the portfolios we run here at Horowitz & Company. We'll do our best with you. We'll set up a time to talk with you as well. And we are going to end it there. We'll see you again next week. And by the way, next week we're going to have year-end tax planning. Bring in an accountant, CPA, to talk about some of the things you could do last minute to make sure that you're on track and to be set up for 2020. So make sure to stay tuned for that one as well. Thanks so much. I'll see you again next week. Nothing discussed in this podcast should be considered a recommendation to buy or sell any security. Past performance is no indication of future results. In addition, the information presented is not intended to be used as a sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should be construed as advice designed to meet the individual needs of any particular investor. Nothing herein constitutes legal, accounting, or tax advice, or individually tailored investment advice. Remember, investing involves substantial risk. Past performance is not a guarantee of future results, and a loss of original capital may occur. No one receiving or accessing this information should make any investment decision without first consulting his or her own personal financial advisor and conducting his or her own research and due diligence, including carefully reviewing any applicable prospectuses, press releases, reports, and other public filings of the issuer of any securities being considered. Please consider this for educational purposes only. As always, use your best judgment when investing. Horowitz & Company, Inc. is registered as an investment advisor with the state of Florida and conducts business in other states where it is properly registered or is excluded from registration requirements. Registration does not imply any level of skill or training.